But then, today, honorable members, I think that you have the agenda in front of you. And then we're dealing with issues of offices of the Department of Labor across the country. And it is the one item that if we are not careful, it may take us a very long time. We just need that we have an understanding that there is only enough time that can be spent on it, and then we have to pass on. Otherwise, we can discuss this for the whole day, because there is, when I press the support of the presentation, there is a lot of holes in the report. And so we just need to manage our time a lot more better. Then we have got the research unit that is going to speak on the fourth industrial revolution. I think this one is going to be the shortest presentation that we ever have. And then, of course, that the department will then also follow into that. Then, other than that, then it is the adoption of the report on the higher panel report. And then it's a set of minutes. That is what is in front of us. The delegation of the department, we have got the acting DG, the name of Ms. Agnilo, or Edgimilo. Edgimilo. With an A. Okay. Then we've got the COO, Ms. Bronkhorst, here. And then we've got DDGO Vigil Sibyl. I hope I pronounced it correctly. Then we've got Becky Maduna, the CFO. We tell us where the money is. And then we have got Mr. Nondrang. Then we have got Nyakemba here. I can't remember my eyes seeing Nyakemba. It's coming by post. Then Greg is not here as well. Greg is not here. And then Nochigila is here. Also not. They are on leave. Then advocate is here. He's on his way. Okay. I think they are shuttle must wrap up. And then Matapuga, I think I saw him. Yes, and then and Mr. Treasure. The chairman at the church. I would like to see this person. I can't see you. Okay.
He's here, very much here.
Thank you very much. That is supposed to be the delegation from the department. And then, of course, I think we also have our own staff here in Parliament, Secretary and Assistant Secretary. And, of course, we have got other interested parties in the work that we are doing. Secretary, apologies.
Thank you, Chair. And Chair, I have received the following apologies. Mr. Trump has a commitment. Mr. America is off, Mr. Nintendo off, and Mr. Paul is off. That's all, Chair. I understand that from the table, please, here.
Yeah, it's just for prohibited to do that. I think we, if there is anything that anybody will do, but we just need to make sure that when we come to the high level report, that we are all here. But I'm hoping that one of the magicians that arrived.
Yes.
Yes. Mm. And then anybody who's moving that agenda, that's Honorable
second agenda.
Chairperson, I would like to move for the adoption of the agenda with the following amendment. I want to move the consideration and adoption of the draft report, the high level report recommendation, as well as the consideration and adoption of the amendment to the two first agenda items, and then we can move forward.
Okay, there's a proposal of amending the agenda so that the report that we're speaking about, and of course in the minutes, to come right up to the front. So it is in view for those members that they are coming. Honorable Teko?
Bring the mic a little bit closer to your mouth.
Okay, thank you. I was saying that the report was already presented before the committee by myself, and then the representative from the Department of Labor presented the responses of the department to the recommendations of the high-level panel. So what I did was just to put our presentations together into one document which is now before the committee, and which has been distributed to the members of the committee. So, yeah, it's just for the committee now to decide. And if there are any input or corrections, then it needs to be made on the document. Thank you.
There we are, honorable members. So remember that these presentations were done to ourselves, and then we discussed them. And then now the report has been put together. Of course, it's putting together what the report was saying, and then what our research unit then was picked up that it affected the Department of Labor and the responses of the department. So presented to ourselves. Honorable Becker.
Thank you, you're getting it right. Thank you. Yeah.
Coming closer.
Yeah, you're very good. Thank you. I'm very happy with this, and thank you for the work that's been done on this. My understanding is that we should, when we look at, say, for instance, the bullet points on page 2, let's just take the first under point 1 on page 2, the bullet points. The way in which we've weighted this, I'm not, obviously it's not weighted, but it's, I mean, obviously unemployment should be the first bullet point. Because it seems to be, I mean, wage inequality is not a major issue in terms of unemployment in the country. In fact, it might, if you try and level the playing fields with wage, you might get more unemployment. So the way I would look at it is put unemployment first and then labour regulatory environment second. Yes, the other issues were there in the report, but that I was looking at that. I mean, if you would go on to page 3 and the causes of unemployment. It's not exactly a cause of unemployment, low levels of employment in agriculture. That's not a cause. That's a symptom. So I'm not sure what we're talking about over here. The cause of unemployment is very different to low levels of employment in agriculture. And in fact, we've got low levels of employment in almost every single industry in this country. So yes, we did talk about agriculture, and it was part of the report. But that's not a cause, so I think we need to re-look at that. You talk about the cause underneath at 2.1.1, and that's fine. Again, at bottom of page 3, also the bullet points are structured the wrong way. Again, I strongly think that we need to re-look at those bullet points, because if you go to page 4, the top bullet point over there, large proportion of the population located in rural areas, that should be actually at the top. That people aren't in the industrial centres, because of apartheid they've been moved out to rural areas. And we should be looking at highlighting that as an issue. So again, I just wanted you to relook. I'm not looking to change the report. I'm just looking to restructure it slightly on that level. And it's also, if you go to page 5, where you've got the points over there, again, I want to restructure it slightly. I'm not pointing at your report again, but I'm saying that point 3 should actually be moved to point 1 on page 5 under 3. You've got then the subsections 1, 2, 3, 4. Again, can you restructure it and have a look at it? Other than that, I want to take you right through the report, but I just wanted to have some sort of lateral thinking as to what is the most serious points and pick it up. People tend to read these reports and they read the first bullet point or the second one, and then they move on to the next point and you don't read on, and then we miss the real issue. We've got real problems in this country, and that my strong belief is, yes, we've got 10 million unemployed, but we're never going to actually find employment for them, and unless we tackle this And we've got it on the agenda as well, the Fourth Industrial Revolution. But we need to recognize that, and I think the high-level panel did recognize that. And they're looking at, and they're looking to try and restructure it completely. So thank you for listening to me, Mr. Chair.
No, I think you accepted that on page 5. I think you must have clarified that whether it's, you have just not extracted it from the panel report as is. And if that is how it is within the panel report itself, then you can't restructure it. Just a second, Honorable Counselor.
Thank you, Chairperson. When I look at the report as a whole, and taking into consideration what the Honorable Baden just indicated, I think it would only be fair on both the members and as well as on the staff members that we propose that this report be referred back to the members on the condition that members make the recommendations or amendments to the report as they or proposals on how they would like the final draft to look like and make the proposals to the content advisor secretary so that when we come back next week we have a clean version with the relevant inputs. Because as I look at the report, this is the as it has been forwarded to the members with no additional or no amendments made by the committee members. So I would therefore would like to propose that the members take the report, go through it, make proposals, recommendations, the members send to the staff, so that they can rework it and bring the clean version back to the committee for possible adoption. Thank you, Chair.
A proposal has been made. Anybody should second the proposal? Honorable Bertram?
I second it.
Thank you very much. Anybody else for the problem of the proposal? Can we then agree on that by, let's say, the end of Friday?
This
we
right.
We have made proposals to the to the writer.
Can you give me the weekend? I'll do it on Monday. Bit lazy. Huh?
Yeah, it's look, I think that if we push it to Monday, it's fine, but you must understand that if they are going to work into this document, we may not have the document before the meeting. We will probably have the document during the meeting or on the night of Tuesday. And I'm not sure whether that would be correct because the fact of the matter is that I would not know what the Honorable President has proposed to the content advisor. And you may propose certain changes which I may not be happy about.
Yeah.
Now there must be space for us to actually interact and deal with that before Wednesday. Now I think if we are talking about Monday, we should understand that we are denying ourselves an opportunity of looking at the document at least a day before. And that has now been redrafted with everybody's input. Some of our own input may be also problematic to each other. Can we speak to that then?
In that case, Chair, point noted, and I therefore think it's only going to be fair for us to have another bite on the amendment that you know proposes that we submitted. So therefore, I don't think it's possible for us to discuss it next week when we present. Then we move it forward. There's no rush, Chair. So there's no urgency for us to deal with it. Not that we don't want to deal with it, but just to be fair towards each other so that we can be sure that the final product is received what we conclude on as a majority or as a collective of this committee. So we'll request therefore that the committee secretary will restructure the committee program and see which is best suitable for us for this agenda item. But no means to be
and then you have not spoken to the last day of the proposal. But for the past, it needs to be very clear. We need to be very clear with what is the last day of the proposal that members will make. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Next week, Wednesday, is the last day of all the proposal. In the meeting, we'll confirm that all of you have made the proposal. And if you have not made the proposal, then you will forfeit the opportunity by every Wednesday. So that then they can start working on the document. Okay, thank you very much. And then the report, then it is referred back. And then, did you have anything to say? Continue.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. In response to the proposal that Honorable Gregory, I just want to state that the manner in which the bullet points are presented here is as they appear on the high level panel report. So, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, I think that is what I just accepted. And but again, that where you've got bullet points that are not numbered, and then there is no priority. There's no priority. That all the bullet points, as placed there, is that they are all of equal, not necessarily equal importance, but for equal recognition. And the bullet points that sometimes create problems of some sort of priorities where they are numbered. And then it sometimes creates an impression that one is more important than the other one. But where you are not putting the numbers into the form of the bullet, and then there's no rating of them. But we have agreed, I think, that let us deal with this next week Wednesday. And see whether all members have made the necessary proposals for correcting or just finalizing the report. Okay, and then can we then look at the set of minutes? Set of minutes for the 24th of October 2018. The meeting that we held right
on the
314. Then the first page, Honorable Bagram.
I propose, and we've all read the minutes that were sent to us, I propose that they're in order.
They are in order. Okay. Just before I take your move, I just wanted to ensure that page 1 does include names of people, that these names have been written correctly, everybody's head. Nobody that has got a problem with any writing of a name. Thank you. Anybody that presented the move by Honorable Bertrand, Dr. Shepard, thank you. And anybody that has a problem for us adopting this minute? None. submitted to the adopter. Of course, if the secretary we have been adopting minutes, but we have never signed the set of minutes. I think when we finish, if ever we finish it, no, it's not going to be possible today. Sometimes tomorrow, that's the whole big part of the minute. Yeah. Thank you very much. We now go to the third unit on the fourth industrial. Our third unit. Are you ready? No. Not the department. We've got our own research unit. We are not relying on the department. Yes. We've got a unit that second guess the department. Yes, and then
Definitely,
we'll call the department.
Oh, is it?
We won't call the department in the name of a research unit. No. When you call the department, you call the department.
So we'll eventually.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
I thought that you were here with when you started the meeting. You have been with us.
Yes.
When we started the meeting.
Yes.
Then did you hear Honorable Tego that opposes you what you propose?
Yes. I
heard
it. In my mind, the research unit is part of the
I tried to summarize that and I said our unit and then the department, then they are going to present one after another, then we can I think you were in Victoria.
No, I had what I wanted to hear.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Proceed.
Okay,
proceed means hard work.
Morning, everyone. Good
morning.
It's going to be an interesting presentation. Plus this is my maiden presentation, the highest quality. Nobody has my head is just a colleague. I'll try to make it to make it short and sweet, just straight to the point. I'm just waiting for the presentation to come out.
Waiting for Bicycle.
Yes, the Bicycle. Because that makes it very
interesting. Some the lighting.
In fact, if it was truly Fourth Industrial Revolution, you'd be a hologram, you wouldn't be here.
Thank you. I'll just talk to it. Actually, what's the background? I know everybody's talking about Fourth Industrial Revolution and all, but the importance of us going back to understanding what happened, what actually happened in the past, whatever that is the first century or second century or in the 1970s. Because this industrial revolution thing has always been taking place. And there's always rumors every time when there's a new development in this industry that people are going to lose jobs, this is going to kill the economy and sort of thing. But every time all human global has actually adapted to the new way. But the most interesting one is this one that we are facing now, the fourth industrial revolution. That everybody's got it. Everyone is afraid that it's going to wipe out people by this job. Can you please go to the next page? This is a graphical representation which is the easy one. On the first industrial revolution, that's when we actually talked, that's when there was a water and steam power. People were scared that it's going to replace industries and manual labor. On the second one, you can look, that was the 20th century. That's when the electricity and mass production was actually taking place. People were also scared during that time about what was going to take place. And on the third industrial revolution, that's when computers started coming to play. And then everybody still thought, well, the robots are going to replace us. Now, in this 4.0, everybody is now certain that actually robots are definitely going to replace them. Now, these are some of the ideas that are actually taking place right now in post-in time. This was just a cultural revolution to try to capture how the 14th revolution looks. Now, I want us to look at how other developing countries are actually, or other developing and developed countries are actually dealing with this matter. On the next slide, you can actually see. On the presentation. If you look at all the presentation on the screen on the side on the slide, I want you to actually look at what other countries are actually currently doing. I intentionally left out South Africa. The reason that I intentionally left South Africa. I don't want us to actually talk about the skill development issues that we are facing. I want us to focus on the labor issues that we are facing. Because in South Africa, I know department is actually still trying to develop in terms of how they're going to play in this role. It's like here in South Africa, when you talk about 14,000 revolution, we're talking about the storm that's coming. We're not talking about the storm that's already here and how we are going to navigate towards the storm. So when you look at our last zooming into that one, the North Korean idea, where now the government has already been providing physical safe space to people that are providing innovative ideas in that industry. When you look at also at Brazil, they put into programs for anybody that's doing innovations aside, they're also getting tax breaks. Now, in China, already in their VAT, they've already incorporated these innovative ideas. Now,
I think members would just look at the out that they have instead of using on the screen. You can speak to your laptop.
Now, when you're looking at the BRICS countries, we know India also has the problem with skills. They have already embarked on implementing programs that they are skilled in terms of cultural India, so people are becoming technologically in China. Now, given all these other what other developing countries are doing with the 14th resolution, I want us also look what is the role of parliament during all this. That means the role of parliament now becomes a different one. Who are you overseeing? If you have to go back and look at our legislation. Our legislation now has to talk about these new jobs that are going to come out of this 14th resolution. Take for example, Uber. Here in South Africa, in terms of what. When you look at the Uber drivers, what are the labor legislation that must be able to actually protect the Uber drivers so that they actually benefit? Do they also, how do we get tax out of Uber? How do we get them contributing UIF? So, how do we get them contributing UIF? Because I know in other countries, the Uber drivers, the Uber company, in order for it to register, is already linked to a particular system where drivers can already benefit. Now, looking at the role of Parliament, now going forward, Parliament now must design a new labour market institution. Here we're talking how are you going to protect it in terms of employment protection, in terms of health and safety, so that we're able to adapt to these changes. Now, as I've actually made an example with the Uber, we now must rethink the social security system and how it will adapt with these new jobs that are going to be created by the 14th Revolution. Yeah, I've already discussed that we need to strengthen in terms of framework to mitigate the inevitable adjustment towards technological changes. As you know, in the 14th revolution, people are now going to be working more of the 6 hours. That means the unionized structure of South Africa is definitely going to lose its power or something. So we also wouldn't want our employees to be exploited in fact. Now, definitely, the parliament must also promote new forms of social dialogue to tailor solutions to challenges that emerge at firm level. As I've already highlighted, develop legislation that assists in preparing youth for future jobs by equipping them with the type of skills that can assist them to navigate the system. Now, I know the government is doing a lot of problems in terms of what, but now, what we need, as I will show you later, most of the jobs that are acceptable to actually organization is those ones, service jobs or routine jobs. And you know, in South Africa, we still struggling. We still have people in the service center, whether it's in the garage or McDonald's. And as you can see with the previous picture, McDonald's already is introducing the service. So you don't necessarily have to find somebody to actually give you a banner. You can just interact with the machine and then go through and get the machine. That means so that person now, as government, we must have now looking into it. What kind of problems can you appeal this person maybe to assist whatever somebody is in the machine, or what sort of skills, the new skills that person can adapt to it. Now, these are the recommendations that I'll like to put to the COVID. This is like going next to the fifth parliament. Changes in employment protection legislation must be considered. Training and education for labor inspectors in to actually be able to inspect this new form of employment. Because now, if you're working 50 hours, if you're working from home, how will the labor inspectors check if I'm actually not inconveniencing my family? If am I working only the 8 hours, or I'm going to make 4 hours, or I'm going to work the whole night? That way now, the work-life balance is now put in the power. Is the labor inspectors going to monitor that thing? Now, the social security system become an important thing. As you are now employing social security, how is the UIF now going to be able to protect and provide financial security to those things? You know, with our tax system, now we need to make sure that whatever things like for Netflix that are now coming, how do we make sure that they actually contribute towards our tax system that are currently existing? Because now these are now products that are not physically here in South Africa that can be in anywhere. Now, government, as I've already said, government must provide sufficient funding for general education and training. In conclusion, as much as we can talk about putting in resolution and say this 41% are the jobs, nobody really knows what the future holds in terms of which jobs are going to be different from the current one. We are all just now playing around with research and models and predict the future just to make sure that as the storm is here, how do we actually navigate towards it? But with the World Economic Forum, it only indicates that 41% of all work in South Africa are the ones that are suitable to implementation. Not everyone will share those there. But with that, what that means, already we know with what percentage, we can already be developing skills problems, try to actually adjust those situations. Digital innovation is changing profoundly the nature of work, in terms of type of jobs that have been created, the skills required for these jobs, and the way work is organized. These trends are definitely challenging the traditional labor market and social policies and require new thinking to help navigate the shape of the new world and work in which to ensure fair sharing and the benefits of these changes may bring to people while limiting their costs. What is important is that as much as we're going to change the labor relations or change all the acts, we must make sure that it's still flexible in such a way that it does not stifle these innovations that are coming into play. So,
thank you very much. Thank you very much. And it is a little bit important, I think, for the preparation of this call. If there's anything that you are aware of in relation to, especially the role of government, whether there's anything that is currently seen in relation to that, and then the department, I think, will come in now. And then let's just create space for the department to be ready. Is there anything that needs to be plugged into the guidance here for some sort of a bicycle?
Thank you, Chair. We have a presentation that we want to do before morning to the polling method. We had wanted to look at the impact of the fourth industrial revolution on a singular level, and look at what the impact of the fourth industrial revolution would have on jobs youth in the country and the funding in the country. We want to give a sense of what the impact is. We wanted to delineate between the different industries that it would impact, but also on the occupational level that we think that the fourth industrial revolution would impact upon. And give a sense of our understanding of what the nature of the fourth industrial revolution would be on the labor market as we go forward. That's the one thing that we want to do. The second thing that we want to preface the presentation on would be the understanding that the fourth industrial revolution is not something that's coming.
It's
not something that we need to prepare for. It's something that we need to engage with as we go forward. There are three examples that before we go into the presentation that we wanted to use, so that we think very clearly and carefully about our response to these issues. And we are in the process of crafting a response, both at the governmental level, but also at the Department of Labor level. The first example that I want to put on the table is the agricultural system. There are two areas in the agricultural sector that already impact on labor. The one is GMO, genetically modified seeds. You now have seeds that are planted that don't need the kind of care that you would have had previously. So it's not your disruptive technology that you have already. It's just disruptive in its nature by and in itself. So it has an impact on the number of people that you have in the agricultural sector. Take an example in the agricultural sector. The farmer now calls his irrigation system, sends an SMS to the irrigation system to irrigate section X, Y, and Z. So it's not those high level that you think that you are dealing with that we need to engage with. It's these things that are on the floor right now. The second example that I want to bring on the table is a few months ago I was in Hamburg container terminal. My apologies. At the container terminal. The only disruptive force was the presence of individuals on the floor, because the trucks that lift and these terminals are automated. You don't have anybody that's on the floor actually disrupts the system. The trucks drive themselves to services, drive themselves to a point where they are refueled. So the reality of the matter is that these disruptive technologies are on the floor, they are here, and we need to deal with. In South Africa, we've done a study in terms of how this disruptive technology will impact on the labor market in South Africa. What are the occupational class categories that will be impacted? What are the race and gender dynamics that we have to contend with South Africa to deal with this thing? So I'm going to ask my colleague Tendani Ramulongo, she was looking for the venue, apologies for being late, to come forward into the presentation. Tendani, if you may take it. I would have loved to do the presentation myself and look clever, but I'd rather have somebody look much more clever than me.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to be here. And my apology once again, I thought it would be suitable for me to travel from home to here. From the shoulder to take time, I had a quarter of it, but just driving to the particular community was the issue. I realized that I should have come with it. So as the DDG already said, industrial revolution is already here with us. The presentation just gave in the initial pages the background or the timeline of the revolution. I'm not going to talk to that since they laid the foundation for this presentation. I will go straight to the fourth industrial revolution. And maybe just to link to what he said, the third industrial revolution was characterized by introduction of information, communication and technology. And the question is, how is it different from the fourth industrialization that we are facing right now? The difference is the pace at which the technology is advancing at the moment. And that pace is threatening the job, as BDG already said. It's threatening the task that people are used to do because technology now is introducing robots, it's introducing, we know the drones, it's introducing all sorts of things that are capable of doing what human beings are doing. I think that's in a nutshell what the fourth industrial revolution is all about. He spoke about the jobs that the fourth industrial revolution is replacing, and there are so many studies that are conducted today to try to look at the impact of this fourth industrial revolution. It's one thing to look at the industrial revolution as a challenge, but there are other opportunities or areas that we should look at as something that will bring up new or create new jobs. So there are new jobs that the fourth industrial revolution is bringing. On the other hand, it's shedding some jobs. And the World Economic Forum did a study to look at the amount and the percentages of jobs that could be shed because of industrial revolution between 2018 and 2022 across the globe. And that rate is showing that while jobs within that same period will be lost at 10% rate, there are jobs that will be created at 11%. And I'll give you the specific numbers of jobs that we tend to lose because of this automatic or automated irrigation, because of this drone, because of phasing away the jobs that people do manually. According to this World Economic Forum, the jobs that are being created or that will be created as new jobs, smart jobs, and jobs that will make people's lives different between 2018 and 2022 are going to be 1.74 million across the globe. They anticipate that this industrial revolution would have the ability to create 1.74 million jobs within that particular time frame. Because the request here was to look at the impact on employment, let's look at what is it that we are losing while we are creating the 1.74 million. What Economic Forum is showing that there will be a loss of 0.98 million in the process. These are the jobs that are done manually, and which this automation, this robot, this digital technology, and the Internet of Things is bringing to the world economy. And I will go now straight to unpack our situation as South Africa. Where is this industrial revolution going to hit us? And we see that there are, as I indicated, studies. One study was conducted by Rooney and them, where they took the current employment statistics of South Africa across all occupations according to Statistics South Africa, and they found it in a system that determines jobs that are standing high risk of being automated, and jobs that are on the medium risk of being automated, and jobs that are on the low risk of being automated. This means that these are jobs that can easily be replaced by automation and machines. Those who stand high risk, and their percentage rate is those who, according to the ranking that they were doing, are 7.0 and above. Those who are at the middle risk, they are calculated as 0.7 if you check one of the slides in the presentation. And on that note, according to Ronnie, we find that South Africa stands to lose or to have 41.9 of jobs which are at a medium rate of risk of being replaced, and the ones that are really, really highly susceptible to be replaced are 38.7%. Only 19.4% of the jobs in South Africa, which is statistics that was taken from the labor market dynamic and the quarterly employment statistics, quarterly employment survey, we tend to lose, if you add the high risk and the medium risk, it's almost 80% of the jobs that are at risk. But as I indicated, we don't have to look at it in a negative way to say that people will lose jobs. This industrial revolution also brings with it opportunities of creating new jobs. The question that we should ask ourselves is how prepared are we with the workforce that we have to be able to take on the advantages of newly created jobs. The other thing that I wanted to share with the House, particularly on this slide, is to look at the other things that the industrial revolution is bringing. DDC said this is not a new thing, it has been there. And when we look at the research that has been done, this industrial revolution is going to bring that, or maybe to increase the pace of flexibility, something that our government has been working hard to guard against. We want people to work, we call them standard employment contracts and conditions. We don't want people who will work few hours and earn in a way that we can't even guarantee that they will be able to sustain their life. So industrial revolution will enhance or increase the rate of flexibility. Because when companies see the opportunities of going automation or robots, then the risk that they might likely want to reduce on the number of people that they might have in their employment for a full-time basis and consider the flexibility. The other thing that our department worked on tirelessly, which I think now is going to be challenged, is on the triangulation of employment. We worked very hard previously on trying to govern triangular employment relations that we are seeing characterizing employment in this country. Triangular employment, which led to us regulating the temporary employment agency. That's where triangulation came in. But with post-industrial revolution, we are likely to see that increasing, as I indicated, because employers won't have the need to keep people in employment for a longer time, over and above having the chance to seek employment of people who will be more skilled or more relevantly skilled according to the needs of the technology that they will be using. The other risk that I want to quickly share is on outsourcing. Where technology brings opportunity to fast-track production or to fast-track delivery of service, employers might opt, instead of getting relevant skills, they might opt to get to source the services of contractors who are specializing on those. And in that case, unfortunately, there will be casualties of those who were in that company having to lose their job. As I indicated, there will be increase in replacement of employment. Unfortunately, one thing that I want us to take away from this presentation is that the new jobs that are coming will come with specialized skills. And the question is, are we ready to be able to provide the workforce that will be in tune to take up the task of the task of the technology that is coming. In fact, I cannot see my friends, but I want to talk now to the graph that shows the impact of this industrial revolution. If we start by the race, the slide that shows race, yeah. Then when we look at that slide, we can see how, in fact, it's linking race and the three categories of medium, high, and low of the jobs that are potentially susceptible to be impacted by the post-industrial revolution. The high risk under African death at 46% if we round it off, it shows that Africans from the current 2017 labor force study, people who are at the risk or high risk of losing or having their job being automated are 46% saying that age with 45.9% represents how automation could affect black within the current employment of South Africa. Followed by the 15% then of medium, but I will only stick with the high rate. Amongst the colors, we find 57% are at high risk. In that population group, we see most people who are currently employed at 45% are at a low risk of having their jobs being replaced. You look now at the Indians, and under the Indians, those who are at a high risk of having their jobs being automated are 29.9%. And amongst the whites, the high risk is lesser at 27.4%. And that number shows that Africans are more vulnerable to have their jobs being replaced. And if we look at what type of jobs that could be automated, then it means that it will be the jobs that are on the elementary level, the jobs that are on the service sectors like our security, like the agriculture sector, probably that's where these people are, and that's why they spend the high risk of having their jobs automated. And automation means that these people might lose their jobs. When we look at gender, we find that males are the ones who stand at the high risk of having their jobs being automated at 40-50%, and the women or females are only at 51%. Still looking at the high risk, and this slide now we break it down according to the different age groups. And when I checked, I saw the people that we consider here our youth as spending a high chance or high probability of having their jobs being replaced. And remember, this is the group that we want to keep in employment. This is the group that, when we look at our employment and unemployment statistics, most of them are unemployed, and 44.1%, in fact, 44.1% is showing that we might incur more unemployment amongst the youth or young people when their jobs are replaced. You add that to the 16-24, still very high at 43.2%. I'll skip to the next slide. This slide now looks at the sector or the industries of our economy where automation is a high risk. And we can see there with agriculture, 64.2% stand the high probability of being automated. And that is the second highest sector, with construction being the highest, with 64% of using automation and thereby rendering those who are currently employed to become unemployed. I will skip with that note of the two mostly affected industries. This next slide is also showing the sectors that are at high risk. In fact, the reason why I singled out these ones, especially the wholesale and retail, the GDG says fourth industrial revolution is already here, and I wanted to emphasize that with what is happening in the retail sector. This is the sector that employs most of our people in South Africa because it does not require the high skills that most jobs need for one to enter. This will be the sector that employs our caretakers, people who put prices on things. And now our thinking, we are already today at a stage where when we get to the till, there's no need for one maybe to unpack their items. With forcing that industrial revolution, the machines are going to even scan and give you the price of all your items within the basket without anyone taking them out and taking them in. the machines are being programmed to a situation where we won't even need someone to check your items as you exit the store, because currently we know that if you take anything that you didn't pay for, something will come out automatically to signal that you are taking out an item that was not paid for. So I see wholesale and retail as one sector that is already into fourth industrial revolution. This is the sector where we see in other countries dropping things that are bought online. And I understand earlier this year, listing of technology already showed its impact on jobs within some retail shops like the Sutterford and Edgar, particularly here in South Africa. We stand chance to lose so many jobs within the workers and retail, if I take that just as an example. We know what's happening with manufacturing. Companies want to use the robot, and the studies are showing the different types of robots, one being the drone that I just mentioned, which would replace so many messengers and driver positions that we have within the country. So construction, I can't even go there. Finances, the service sector, I think that's where our security personnel also falls in, and they are likely to be replaced because you know, I think within the security industry, technology is also so advanced that I don't need someone to sit on my gate to make sure that there's no burglary or unauthorized breaking. Those things are currently being done without a human being there, and that's the case and the force that the fourth industrial revolution is giving us. Okay, I was just explaining, it's trying to show where these are some of the sectors that will be affected. We know South Africa, through the public works and other measures that government is doing to reduce unemployment, I see so many people working in the health sector, providing the home care, basic care. Those are the people that the automation that the DDG mentioned on agriculture are likely to impact on them when a cell phone can remind someone to take their medication without you needing a human being to be there to make sure that the medication is taken. So I just highlighted this as some areas where automation is really having big potential of replacing the tasks and the jobs that people are doing. When looking at the request, we thought that this committee would also want to know the impact of fourth industrial revolution on unionization. That is the job of trade union. And on that note, I wanted to indicate that is also going to be impacted on. But we believe that COSATU, we believe that ITUC and any other national and international workers organizations are looking at this and the potential it's having on their mandate of organizing and of ensuring that workers are protected and workers' rights are protected. So because of the fourth industrial revolution, their jobs are also at stake. Their mandate is also threatened because of the diminishing number of workers. So it's not only on the trade union. If we look at bargaining councils, we look at our own as the Department of Labor, as an institution that is responsible of ensuring that workers, for example, are under occupationally health situations. Now, fourth industrial revolution is bringing in the virtual work areas. This is a challenge that, as government, we have to relook at how do we now exercise the mandate of ensuring occupational health, whereby people will be scattered all over, whereby offices or workplaces are no longer the physical space that we are used to go to conduct inspections on. So there are several areas of fourth industrial revolution over and above employment. I just picked out the governance of work, and I'm singling out trade unions, I'm singling out labor administration that is responsible. for workers, but there are other institutions. Our neglect, for example, would also be putting a challenge to rethink the ways that they are doing things, because the definition of employment, in fact, employment related, is changing. I indicated the triangular. Our laws are crafted in a way that employment relations was triangular. A two-way, employer and employee.
Then, yeah,
but
yeah.
There's one aspect coming in. So I'll speak that and the next, let's talk to you. The next is talking to recommendation. Before I talk to the recommendations, I just want to remind the House that businesses will make their decision on maximizing the profit wherever their strategy directs them to invest in. And with the fourth industrial revolution, those decisions are going to be affected seriously, because businesses are going to consider production or rendering their services in areas where the localized skills challenge. And this, when we consider our workforce in South Africa, the employed and the non, the unemployed, we know that majority of those people are unskilled. If we say full industrial revolution is here tomorrow, we know that we are not going to cope. And those who want to maximize profit will not consider us as a country where they can direct their production or direct their business, because they won't have the matching skills for the fourth industrial technology that RO4 is bringing. So on that basis, I just want us to see that there's very important aspect of making sure that the labor force is skilled, and the challenge is the gap that we have of the number of people who have no skills and irrelevant skills as compared to the post-industrial revolution expectations. And in my concluding remarks, in fact, I want to go back to the levels of risk analysis. I think I emphasized those previously. Just skip that slide. Okay. Based on the fact that our country needs skills, and in this case, skills that will match the needs of the fourth industrial revolution, then our conclusion is that employment outcomes are not cast in stone, and policies, which is what I think the committee, the department, and its social partners are responsible of. The policy is crafted proactively, the policy is crafted in the best way after assessing the skills that will be needed by the fourth industrial revolution can help the country not to lose. As much as I tried to project, those are the estimations, but they are estimations with the people for us to see where the things are going and what could possibly be done. And to reskill, to upskill, and as I indicated, business will only check where they can quickly go and make profit and more profit. If we are not at the stage that they can use our workforce and they still have to reskill or to upskill, they will go where the skill is already available, and that worsens the scenario of job losses in South Africa.
Yes,
The second bullet.
Is it properly crafted? Correctly crafted, and you will make sense out of it.
Yes, if I can explain it in the second bullet and it's to the big step. What we are trying to say is that if we are less prepared as a country, we stand the high risk of losing jobs. In fact, I can see the proactive of the country. But if we are less prepared, if we are less proactive as a country to match the tide of fourth industrial revolution, we stand to lose jobs. The first baby bullet is saying that directly we will lose jobs if we are less proactive, if we are less prepared, we will lose jobs due to the changing nature of domestic production. This is linked to who is investing here domestically to produce. What is it that they look for? We know up to now countries, investors in South Africa attracted to invest because there was a need for unskilled labor. We used to have cheap electricity. So there were things that attracted people to our country. But this fourth industrial revolution is bringing us a mental, it's evolving our minds to say, are we now going to still use unskilled labor as an advantage to be considered by anyone who wants to invest to do business in South Africa? This fourth industrial revolution, that falls away. That competitive advantage of our country falls away. We know the problem of electricity, I can't even mention it. So it means that there's a call for South Africa to prioritize skills, relevant skills that will be able to cope with fourth industrial revolution. Indirect, due to international market, we know South Africa is in the global economy. We are competing with other countries, and the competition is about trying to be the best. You know, we can only be the best if we prepare the workforce to be in tune with the fourth industrial revolution. I think I clarified the second bullet and sub bullet underneath.
Yeah, I think my problem was reading the English because I did English third language. So I think when you say the less prepared and less productive, that it solves my problem.
Yeah.
That's why I had the whole confusion,
yeah.
Because the two ways were contradictory. And then, but if you insert that other less in front of productive, then it makes sense to me. You're done.
I think I was done on that last slide, still stressing that let's focus on formulating comprehensive workforce strategies that will meet the challenges of the fourth industrial revolution. And let's be proactive and influence policies that will not see us losing. We know our goal is to make sure that we have decent work. We committed to goal 8 of the sustainable development goals. We are faced with unemployment, inequality, and this presentation shows how fourth industrial revolution can draw us back away from the goals of reducing poverty, of reducing unemployment, and of inequality. If this workforce is unskilled, the gap of inequality will become worse.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I think together with our research unit and on this fourth industrial revolution. Honorable members, I think we just need to get the figure right of our total employment that we have currently in the country. I just heard to Honorable Bagra that he's talking about 10 million unemployed. And then last month they were talking about 9 million. And about 3 months back, the DA has been talking about 8 million. And the figure is just jumping up continuously. I just hope that next month we'll talk about 11 million.
I hope so too.
But at the end of the day, it's for us to actually think. I understand the recommendations that is coming. But the question, of course, is when you have the all employment opportunities that we have currently that has been taken up, you have this fourth industrial revolution coming, then 80%, that's the highest media, then it is vulnerable for replacement by automation. And then on one side, you have got this 10 million, supposed to be correct from the DA, or just average 8 and 10, it's just about 9 million of unemployed. Who wants work? When those that are working are vulnerable, 80% of them. And then what is the capacity of this country, together with its economy, to actually manage that kind of an impact? to really have to really concentrate on these recommendations here that talks about risk feeding and whatever only, or do you have to try and manage the impact of the fourth industrial revolution? Then the question of the interventionist of the state then comes in. Because currently the way that the two have presented, they have presented this in a free market economy where everything just happens on its own. And then we just have to adjust. Because I mean it's capital, of course, we have been taught that capitalism will always adjust to market forces. Doesn't matter what sort of disruption it brings me, it will just adjust. But the question is the social factors on the ground. When you've got people that are not educated and then the capacity of them to adjust, then it's very little. Then it calls the government then to intervene as and when it is required. Okay. I've talked a lot of nonsense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to applaud both our researcher and the department for coming forward with this research, because I think this is groundbreaking and it's not the future. It's not what's going to happen. It's happening already. On a daily basis, we're seeing people saying that they... for instance, this morning I spoke to a client of mine in my wearing another hat who said that he had outsourced certain of his work to Pakistan. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, I've outsourced the work to Pakistan. We need to now retrench about 50 people. And I said, well, couldn't you outsource it here in South Africa? And he said, it's too dangerous, because once you outsource here in South Africa, people then talk about insourcing, and then you've got that problem and you've got to face that. He said he'd rather do it. He'd outsource it to Pakistan, and once he's outsourced to Pakistan, they've got the problem. They get the employment, but if they want to insource something, they can't, because it's in South Africa. Now, I want to go one step further. When we're talking about definitions of employment, and we're talking about workplaces, we've got to have a complete rethink, and I think the department hasn't rethought this at all. When we had these debates over the national minimum wage, I kept saying that the biggest hotel group in the world does not own a hotel. They don't own one hotel, they don't own one room. The biggest hotel group in the world, which is Airbnb. The biggest taxi industry in the world doesn't own one car. When you talk about the lady who lives in the house next door to me, whose family have left and she now has Airbnb and she rents out 5 rooms, and she employs 2 or 3 people to look after the rooms and clean them and whatever, that's a workplace, and it's very difficult to then start assessing whether she's health and safety, etc., etc. How do you actually look at that, and is she doing the proper thing? What about the cases that we've recently seen on the Uber cases? They've been running through our courts, and our courts have had real problems on that. The Uber cases have run all the way to the Labour Court. They're probably going to land up at the Constitutional Court eventually. But a man who owns a vehicle and registered himself as an Uber driver, he's not an employee, although the national minimum wage defines him as one. But he truly isn't an employee, or he employs himself or something. I don't know how they're going to do it. This is a big issue, and I think this committee needs to be seized with this on a more practical basis, because I can tell you right now that every single business, it doesn't matter whether you're saying this is the free market or capitalism or whatever it is, every single business looks to see what is the cheapest way in which they can produce something. And so the lady, sorry I forgot your name and I apologize, from the department is absolutely correct. Business is there to make a profit, and we need to harness that and say, how can we ensure that these businesses remain in South Africa and remain profitable. Because the minute the business is not making a profit, they're either going to close down or look elsewhere. And we're seeing this right now, every single day. My strong suggestion is that we start re-looking at all the labour legislation and have a look at how we can actually enhance the legislation to encourage people to employ it. We have our president who's brought in some wonderful investments into this country, but I would challenge this committee to do an oversight to go and have a look at one or two of those new factories in the Eastern Cape, the motor vehicle factories, which used to employ 10, 20,000 people, are now employing 20 technicians, and the rest of the factories run on machinery. How do we explain that to the workforce? We can't, because it's all done by machinery. And we need to have a look at encouraging people to invest in businesses that are labor intensive. We shouldn't have jobless growth. We obviously have to have, but we shouldn't have. We shouldn't be encouraging that. We should be looking at labor-intensive investment. And so I welcome this report very strongly, and I think all of us need to go back, digest this, and come with ideas as to how can we as a country accept that this is happening, because it's already happened. Accept it's happening and then go forward. If I want an opinion, I want a legal opinion for my law office. I put this onto the internet, the question. I sell it to a group of researchers in India, and overnight they come back to me with an answer. I don't need attorneys for that. I don't need lawyers. And those are specialized people. I don't need them. Never mind the labor intensive industries. And we've done that. We needed some advice on a strike. We sent it through to a company on the internet. They went to people in India. They are experts in South African law. They've got all the law there. They work on it overnight. The next morning I've got an opinion and I can charge a client. Normally what I would do is I would get three attorneys to work for 2 days on that and then give an opinion, and then they can charge their fees. I don't need it anymore. It cost me 500 rand and I've now got an opinion and I can send it to a client. So I don't even need lawyers anymore, because I can send it out. So we need to think about it very carefully, but thank you for that opportunity, Mr. Jay.
Okay, any other?
Yes,
I think this, what is much more also important is that we have gone in a job summit. The main is to deal with our high unemployment rate. Then we have gone to an investment summit. Then the main aim as well is really to create employment so that we deal with our high unemployment rate. Now, your research report says 80% of these people that are in this industry, in all these where we are having some sort of investment, as the Honorable Barker is talking about in the manufacturing and whatever, you say that they are vulnerable, 80%. But your report is just missing one thing now, that is a problem. The technicians in the manufacturing industry, they are now almost 100% vulnerable. The technicians. Because now they are going to be replaced by machines. Unlike the sweepers and those that you talk about, low skilled or uneducated, the actual technicians are there. Those that are actually in charge of manufacturing the vehicle or manufacturing any machine that the industry is doing. It's a cry now that they are actually the most vulnerable now, as we speak. Then now your high and the medium and the low now will change a little bit, which means that you may have start approaching 90%. 90% of job opportunities that are vulnerable for automation. Then the investment we have been talking about last week will only assist us to grow our economy. But the likelihood is it may not have any impact on-job opportunities. It may not have an impact on creating job opportunities, because you're just going to bring in a new factory, and then it starts building a lot of cars, but using robots in them. So then our GDP will go up, but unemployment as well will follow the GDP. That's why now I'm saying, which Honorable Butler is not agreeing with me, when I'm saying that the state needs to play a role in order to manage the impact of it. And of course that what it was in my head is what he actually concluded with, that there's a need of a deliberate policy making in relation to certain job sectors for labor-intensive production. Yes, private capital will do run for profit and all these other things, but then we have to manage where the state is the source of investment, like saying it's in our road maintenance, and then whatever is done by public works or whatever, then we can legislate that they will use manual labor or whatever in the maintenance of those, and then wherever the government invests itself, then it can legislate to actually direct how the work should be done in order to close this gap. Because surely if you've got 10 million people that are unemployed, and then you've got another 20 million that are employed now, and 80% of those that are employed, they may be unemployed tomorrow to join the 10 million, then we are going to be in a bigger problem. Honorable Pascal, please.
Thank you, Chief. I want to welcome the presentation that's been made, especially the enthusiastic approach by our researchers. We have done the first presentation. And I won't go into the areas of concern raised by the previous speaker's presentation. However, it's a point of concern that we just presented. The state of affairs in terms of our readiness, in terms of the COVID-19 revolution, because we saw things evolve and we are not ready. But my question to the department would be, you indicated that there's 10% jobs that will be lost, and then you indicated about the 11% that will be kept. Can you give us an indication, whilst you've given us an outline of in which sectors the jobs will be lost, but you are silent on which sectors will jobs be gained? The reason why I'm asking that question is, when we look at the workplace key trends, that has to be submitted, the confinement of labor is increasing. So my idea is, while there's training needs that's been identified there, and the plan, and then they report again to the department to say what is the training in terms of the workplace conferences indeed materialized. We need to have a proper monitoring mechanism in place, and also maybe the intervention by the department to direct the employers in terms of the critical skills that are going to be needed in future, in order for them to be guided on which areas will then be needed in terms of reskilling. So then we need to amend or direct the workers to make plans accordingly to make provision for that. That's a proactive approach I would assume. So in order to remedy that situation. And that is, in short, my conservation checklist.
Thank you. Honorable Adi.
So thank you, Chairperson. I think what has been reported is an open secret. We know all this.
Okay.
We know that there are problems. You today go to the banks. There are fewer workers like it was before. Like you said, you go to the metal industries, etc. We know that there are fewer workers compared to before we met. Hence, I'm saying that which you are putting here on the table is what is already known. Perhaps what you were supposed to be saying to us is what we as Parliament and the government as well are supposed to do. I'm saying this because, in my own opinion, that has not been put on the table at all. What must we do? What must we go to the House through the mouth of the chairperson of us and say to the country via Parliament, this is what must be done? I mean, we know there is a great level of unemployment in South Africa. I know there are contradictions where some amongst us, in this instance I'm referring to Parliament and political parties, some will say 27%. I have said 40% together with my party, and others have come up with whatever percentages. Okay, some of us, for example, have said even the jobs summit was a repetition to what we had in 1988 and is therefore unnecessary, etc., etc. Now, it's all those things, but I want to repeat that you need to understand that not by hook or crook, we have got to be given information. This, ladies and gentlemen, here, as he said, can't come up with any scientific, you know, argument to play on the basis of this. Let us move forward. Permit me, therefore, through your chair, to say, I don't think from where one is seated, one is happy with this. Why? Because I want to repeat, you have not given us the direction. Yes, here's the situation. What must we do? Yes, we know that technology grows and it cannot be stopped. What must we do to make sure that the people of South Africa get employment? Yes, we know that every year the numbers of children that register for matric are 1 million or above, but the ones that write the final examination in matric are about 250,000, and less than 200,000 will pass. Therefore, those are the ones that can go and do technological studies, but they can't because of the high levels of unemployment in the country, and therefore their parents are unable to do that. You should be advising us so that we then can be able to go and say, this is one thing that should be done so that we then can be able to move forward. I'm therefore saying that computerization, in my own understanding, plays the second fiddle. Now it is a primary requirement. Tell us what we must do, because you have it. Like I have said, you have this kind of levels of unemployment and therefore the high levels of poverty. Okay, are we at the sequel to that which you have said going to improve the situation? What must we do You have not said that to us, DG, and your delegation here. We know again that in South Africa today, with all the high levels of unemployment, what is happening? You have people from outside the borders of South Africa who come here. You move around to, I want to repeat, to those restaurants, to wherever, to the petrol stations. You know better. The people who are there will be from Zimbabwe and you know, from beyond the seas of Africa, South Africa, wherever. And these are the people, some of them have, I mean, are graduates from universities, etc. But then they will take tips and go on and work and not say the salary, etc. Tell us what we must do. So I'm therefore saying to Chairperson, yes, you have told us what we know. This is the problem that we face with. But what must we do to make sure that we move forward and solve this thing? If you are not ready as yet through your chair, can we therefore request that the a department goes and then looks into us and comes back to say to us, do 1, 2, 3, so that through you we can go to the parliament and say, parliament, do this. And say, parliament, instruct government to do 1, 2, 3, etc. Through a proper scientific analysis and whatever empirical analysis that you as the department shall have come up with. You have told us what we know. Must we go to the petrol station? There is a Zimbabwean worker. Go there, okay? Just go there. Not even in South African way. You all know that. We all know that. I therefore would appeal through your chair that more has got to be done, so that we then can be able to look into that. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. I think there is correctness in what you have said.
Sorry, just thank you, Mr. Chair. 1 second to arising out of what the Honourable Matisha has just had to say. In fact, we've got to look further than the Zimbabwean working at the petrol station. Further than that is, when you go into a petrol station in London, you fill up your own petrol. There are no helpers on the forecourt at all. And that, I think, is about 700,000 jobs in South Africa alone. Now, when the petrol workers, on the petrol jockeys went on strike, my comment to some of the jockeys were, and I went to the unions to say, whoa, don't go on strike, because the bosses will start thinking about saying, well, we don't need this altogether. It's very dangerous. We're in a dangerous situation. We can't afford to lose the work at the petrol stations. We can't afford it. It's 700,000 people. Every single one of them looks after 4 people. So that's over 2 million people would go hungry if we had that question and there were strikes on the petrol station. So that's the fourth industrial revolution. The fourth industrial revolution is when you get out of a car in New York and you want to fill up your car, all you do is you go and press a card and you put the nozzle in yourself, and there's no, and we can't afford that. So we've got to think very carefully before we even talk about Zimbabweans. We've got to go one step further. Thanks.
Look, well, thanks, and I'm tempted to say there's a request for a paper, and that it only makes sense, because definitely, of course, is that you have actually outlined the this annual that is coming, which I think also on another side of the mouth we say it is here, but we know that it is not here to enforce. There are serious elements, more than 50% of the fourth industrial revolution, that is still coming. At the moment, it's just elements of the fourth industrial revolution. We may say it is yes, because of those elements that you go to a vending machine, then you put a 5 rand there, and then you get a tin of cold drink or a packet of tea. Yes, and then they are just elements. At one time is that you may not need to put a coin or whatever. You see, it's, you may just simply what, like as you're saying, is a card or something that has got whatever the monetary unit that you are using to purchase, and then you just simply wipe there. Then the thing, the cold drink that you want, then comes out. And in future, when you have got the full force, you may not even move from home. Then you will just do certain things at home, then that little flying machine then brings the Coca-Cola to your house. Brings the Coca-Cola right to your house. I'm sure you may have seen the advert of the World Cup in Russia. The advert that was used for the World Cup, right? Them carrying the beer coming and deliver to some other side, here and there. So definitely it is possible. It is possible. But like as we are saying, that there is a need to unpack, because we can't say government is doing nothing about the fourth industrial revolution. I don't think we are saying that. We may not be knowing. So is that this particular paper, when it talks about the fourth industrial revolution and its implications, then it must go next step and tell us what is our state, our government, currently doing about the fourth industrial revolution. Before you come down to the level of the department and the impact in the department sector, labor sector. And then, like as I've said, is that we may be currently going around seeking to create job opportunities in the form of the job starting investment, luring investors to come to the country. Then put the equation. When that investment comes, what are we getting from that investment? Definitely is that the economic growth will go up, but can we say that it will be translated into job opportunities?
That's the point.
That's what now you must talk to. And if it's translated into job opportunities, for whom? And are we helping those people that those job opportunities will come out for them? Because now you have the job opportunity of somebody to manage robots. And you have got nobody skilled to manage those robots currently. And the other issue then that comes in is the categories, the current labor force that we have, and then relative to where we are going to, which is impacted by the fourth industrial revolution. The refilling that you are speaking about, we appreciate that. It's just one little thing that needs to be done. But remember that majority, let me not say majority, a bigger chunk of your current labor force may not be retrainable. And then when you offer them for packages, you will have people from the age of 50 to upward, then opting to take packages because now you are bringing certain animals that they can't work with in the workplaces. But then when they get out, then they are also clocking your compensation, your IF system, the other side. And then you start having a problem. But also as you are considering this particular paper, remember that we have got two economies in the country. You have got something that we may call it a formal economy and an informal economy. And then the fourth industrial revolution, which one is it going to impact more? more, and which one is not going to impact more, and what is there that can be done to mitigate the impact of the fourth industrial revolution. They should be coming up with those issues. And what is the role of government? The role of government. Can we afford to have a government that folds its arms and say market forces do as you please? And then we'll see the consequences. Or a government that will actually try to intervene and make sure that the consequences are not as the market forces wishes. There's a lot of money that government keeps in the city, invests in the infrastructure of the country and all that. And there is some saying that there is a hymn called the whatever, change the tune or whatever, all those other things. If we have got all the money that we are putting in, we have got the right to also regulate how the money should be spent. The public investment, and then we have a right to regulate it in order to produce the outcomes that we want to see. Yes, we are a global player, but not 100% a global player. We are a country in transition, and the transition has to be managed. And the management of this transition brings in the intervention in character of the state. And therefore, it's on the recommendations and the rights, and then you should explore what that government can do to actually deal with the township economy, the rural economy, the formal economy, and then what are the chances in the formal economy. In the formal economy, because you're going to bring in outside and foreign investors, there is very little that you can dictate to them how they can manufacture their vehicles in their own factory. Very little that you can do. But with SANRA, where we give it money to build the N2 in the Eastern Cape, we can tell them that 50% of all the work that should be done there must be done in labor-intensive manner. We can say so. In order to transition the older folks that are not educated, that they rely on their hands to do work, then to actually get themselves out of the labor sector system over a couple of years of time. While you know it's on the formal sector and the rest, then you've got the full flow for the industrial production getting in. But then you've got another part of the economy that deals with those that actually cannot adapt to the new ways of doing things. Well, continue.
Thank you, Chair. I actually welcome the comment. I also don't like to engage this in a matter as an academic exercise. Hence, I actually didn't want to go into discussions in terms of how, what is South Africa currently doing or planning to do. I actually wanted to us to move away from the discussion of this is what's taking place, this is what we want to do. I want us to move into the place that where we now look at how our legislation is actually prepared in terms of what is actually taking place. How are we going to treat it going forward? I mean, that's how I sort of understand. But I mean, I also take the comment, maybe, or also be in conversation with the department.
Yes,
yeah,
it
could
be government on its own. And the procedures was there. Do you want to speak before, eh?
Yep, I'd appreciate the chair.
Okay.
Because I think we know some of the comments, and we will work together with the research unit here to deal with some of these issues. But the issue of the fourth industrial revolution is a subset, and the impact thereof is a subset of our unemployment crisis. That's not the be-all and end-all of the unemployment crisis that we have. And some of the work that we've done in terms of the job summit, which I would differ with the Honourable Member Madisha in relationship to, it's the same as that we had in 1998.
Okay.
Yeah? Because it deals with different issues, and some of the problems of the pact that we've had in the past was that there was no monitoring mechanism in relationship to how we've structured these pacts, these agreements that we've had. The job summit, which we probably would have do a submission at the later stage to the portfolio committee, will try and unpack some of these issues and the differences that we wanted to see in terms of that. And I think it's an important element that we'd want to raise. But I also think, Chair, that we probably need to separate the issue of migration and the fourth industrial revolution. To the extent that these two are not, while it may have an impact one on the other, it's not the same issue that we're talking about. We'd want to give the portfolio committee of the state of our understanding of what the impact of these would be, given that the policy that government has currently on the table is in place. What would be the state of the impact of this fourth industrial revolution on our economy? On our employment, that's the position that we wanted to put on the table, so that we have a clear understanding what would be the impact on different categories of occupations, different categories of and classes of whether it's race and gender, the different demographics that we wanted to give an understanding of what it is, so that when we move forward in terms of realizing policies to deal with these issues, we know where these policies should be directed in terms of it. So the job summit talks about what are the educational interventions that we need to have, whether the vocational education training system that we currently have deals with the concept that we have, the problem that we have, deals with the fourth industrial revolution impact on all of those jobs that we want to create in relationship to that. And it's an important element of the difference of the job summit as we have within the past. So it's important that we understand it. Let me try and explain the difference in relationship to the 10 and 11% asked by Honourable Van Schalkwyk. So the 10% is in relationship, and again, these numbers are flux numbers, if you will. It depends on how we encompass and how we take this fourth industrial revolution demand on. So these numbers are flux numbers. These are not static numbers that we have. But the 10% is in relationship to the current occupational classes that we have, the skills that we have, and the possibility of the jobs that may be lost as a result of the fourth industrial revolution. The 11%, the possible growth of 11%, are those jobs that can be created in order to respond to the fourth industrial revolution. So, for example, if we in our schooling system entrench the principle of the coding as an example, which the Indian government has included within the curricula as an example. Therefore, if you go to Silicon Valley, the majority of the people that you will find employed in Silicon Valley are Indian population people. So therefore, if you take up these kinds of possibilities and we speak to the vocational training and primary education, because you've got to address the whole education system, not only in terms of primary education, you've got to do primary education, secondary education, you've got to deal with vocational training as well. So there are industries here's the impact that I think that we need to look at. What are the people that will be mostly impacted on our occupational, on the fourth industrial revolution, and how do we deal with that? It's not a question of dealing with legislation will play a part in that and respond to some of these realities, but how do we provide the additional protection for those workers that will remain within the fourth industrial, within the third and second tiers of revolutionary impact in terms of the jobs that are still being there. Accountants, for example, is an industry that will be phased out completely, because I don't need an accountant. I plug those numbers into the computer, and they will. CFO.
He almost clapped you.
Doctors, research has indicated that a machine has a 95% probability of providing the proper diagnosis, rather a 95-50% diagnosis than an individual,
GP, yeah.
Than a GP. So doctors will be, and if I put in the correct parameters, doctors are going to be. I know you want to go to the for a sick note to the doctor, but so we got to look at it within that context, understanding what the impact is going to be, and deal with the impact, and change our educational response, change our economic response to that. Change our macroeconomic fundamentals in order to deal with the reality that we have. So the investment conference, primarily to the investment summit, was the impact on what are the jobs that would be created in terms of the investment that you have. And we will try and give you a sense when we do the presentation on the job summit on all of these realities. And we think it will answer to some of not necessarily provide the only answer to these, but provide a considered response to these in that presentation that we are required to do.
Okay, so it's she has got almost nothing to say now.
No, I'll just
add.
I want to add on the 10%, 7%. And my ad will be on jobs to be created. The 11%, we lose 10, but we create 11. And it will link to your input on the technicians. So I think in terms of the technicians, they won't be irrelevant. Those are the skilled people that will reskill now to be able to deal with the robots and the all those things. Then the jobs are on, I didn't put them on the slide, data analysts. We know with technology there's a lot of, they call it big data. When you call Uber, you are adding onto a database somewhere of your details. When you do all those things online, we are creating what they call big data. So jobs of analysts, data analysts, because of the big data issues that industrial revolution is creating, will also lead to more new jobs. Some statistics on scientists, software developers, robot developers. So all those things that are coming to replace employment will also need human beings to interact or work on them at a certain extent. But the biggest problem is that we currently are not in that phase of education. My DVD was indicating the whole solution of this fourth industrial revolution for our country is in the education, it's in the training. You indicated that we receive workplace skills planning, the analyze sector skills. I think there's still a gap somewhere within ourselves as government that it's like we're not analyzing, or in fact it will go back to employers and what they are reporting, that they're not reporting fully what they actually need. Because those skills, workplace skills, things are analyzed, skills are outlined. The skills list is updated based on those, but when you look at them, it does not really talk to what is needed. And as someone indicated, there will be that need of collaboration between those needs that the industries want, what education should provide and government providing an effective environment to nature those. So I just wanted to add on which types of jobs are we looking at, the big data. Someone should analyze, because businesses are already doing that. They analyze the big data to know what is it that Honorable Madisha wants online every day. They know what they know, and they can customize their business towards a majority of the needs that most people want. So I think that's where we are going to create more jobs for people who should be able to analyze direct business strategies, ensure that the business flourishes and we know what multiplication will come out of that, our economy will grow, and then maybe at some point we will have less inequality and less unemployment and less. So, but I just wanted to add on those that yes, we appreciate the input. We saw the intervention specifically on education and training, though it didn't come out clearly in the presentation, even as the homework that when we go back, we will try to look at concretized proposals as to what actually needs to be done to deal with this problem. So this is here. What is happening that is just growing? It won't go away. The previous speaker indicated the issue of petrol attendance. We know petrol attendance in other countries have been phased out a long time ago. Our trade unions at some time when I engaged them, they indicated how much they thought to keep petrol attendance unemployment here. But the reality that we are facing right now is that it's over and above petrol attendance. Will they have the energy to fight for all these things? I think the best way is for us to prepare ourselves for the young ones that are coming. For those ones, certain that we say are about to be phased out, yes, we can reskill, encourage them to get out of the workforce, but let's get to be worried about the young ones that are coming. You saw my presentation indicate the impact on the 15 to 34. Those are still going to be stuck in our labor market, and those should be our group that we should focus on.
Okay. I think we need to get out of this subject now, Honorable Brother. Because the next one, I think, you've got much more interest as well.
No, I won't have. I won't have much more interest. This I'm very interested in. I just wanted to make one comment, if I may. We had a wonderful job summit. I personally don't think it was worth all that much. Because if you're looking practically, what we need in the fourth industrial revolution, skills are out there around the world. Skills are available. So when I recently went to Israel and I said to them, what are they doing about the fourth industrial revolution? I went to a place called Innovation Nation, where they put together a hub of innovators. And they said what they do is they attract young Americans who are specialists, normally master's students in this type of computer science. They attract them to Israel so that they can in turn get jobs over there in Israel, and part of their job certificate is they are obliged to train four others in 2 years. Now, our department is at the helm of job applications. We should be going out there and actually encouraging people to recruit experts from around the world to come to South Africa, and as part of their application they must undertake to train at least four South Africans or more per annum. Now, we don't seem to have put that together. The job summit should have actually tackled something like that, because that's practical. We can do it right now. I'm dealing with someone now who wants to bring in people, and they're struggling to get job permits to bring people in who are highly specialized. So that's my comment on the job summit. Thanks.
Okay. Roncos, who wakes up every day and gets worried about the positive?
You.
No.
He worries.
No. You know what you expect from me. Talking about the fourth industrial revolution is that the person who wakes up every day and worry about that. Because if you say it is him, then it is part of, then it becomes part of a by the way responsibility. It becomes a by the way responsibility. You know how much problems you have in your hand. Surely these days they are just overloading you. And then You'll have a burnout very soon.
Thank you that you see it.
Yes, you'll have a burnout very soon. And because you see, it's discussions and outcomes of that fourth industrial revolution on what the department should do is what must be sent to him to bring in a policy that is suitable to sort out that problem. Now you want to put him on the research and development on the fourth industrial revolution, when you need to actually make a decision on a step that you have to take to deal with a particular matter, then you give it to him, then he deals with the actual difficulties of putting up a policy, coming up with a policy that actually solves the problem that he wants to resolve. I think that this is one thing that we just need to think a little bit better about that. Then don't make it a part-time job or a by the way thing that you can just simply throw as an attachment to somebody else or some other thing. So think, internalize it. You really need to make it a part-time thing to think about this fourth industrial revolution. You need somebody that will work on that on a daily basis. When there is a conference on fourth industrial revolution, that person will move and attend, come back, report, see how it affects the department, and then feed the relevant PCG, and then on what impact on them. And then, I'm not the DG to direct you, but I'm just simply flashing the light. Do you want it to be a part-time job, or do you want somebody to champion that and make sure that the department adjusts correctly and in time, wherever it has to do it? And then how do we impact on UIF? How are they going to pay this benefit to people in the next year or two with the 40 industrial revolution? The compensation part, the method of payment. Are we going to see these people that flocked at the offices of at the labor center to go and register to get their payment, blah, 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 into the car? It is not possible that they can do it without even walking to your labor center. Because definitely you've got problems with offices. We're still going to hear you just after now. Why do we have to bring people? People must flock to the office. And then when you have got all this sort of automation in front of us, why don't we automate certain things that people don't necessarily need to walk there just to go and claim 1,000 rand. But then he stands there in the queue at your office for half the whole day. So I think those are the things that let's see the paper. You may translate it to a presentation, but let it be a paper. The paper, let it tell us this was industrial revolution and its impact. Then now in the country, and how the country is currently responding to it. And then now you press down now to your microscope of the department, and then how you are currently dealing with that, and what it is the gaps, and how then make the proposals going down, how you can deal with that. But I appreciate the scope. I still say that we have got two economies. Don't talk as if we have got one economy. And then the two economies, they are different now. They are almost operating as if they are operating on different sets of rules. Although that they are expected to work on the same route, but currently, I mean, you take the taxi service. The taxi service, not following any law. No. But it's expected that they are registered in like any other vehicle that transports people, it's expected to comply and whatever. You give them a ticket for violating the rule, then they come to me, don't pay. And all that. So, which means is that let's just unbundle it. And then, of course, it's to say, oh, is that, remember that when you speak about legislation in Parliament, legislation doesn't come just. It comes because there is a particular gap in providing services. Then you bring legislation to deal with that gap. Now, you need to talk to these on the paper and then advance this force industrial revolution and its impact. If this is the current conditions of the economy of the country, then its social makeup. And then expose the gaps. And then now, then legislation should come in and deal with those gaps. So thank you very much, and I think we need to appreciate you and the work that you have done. And then it is eye-opening and agitating as well. And we are hoping that when that particular paper comes, then I'm sure we'll be highly agitated. But at least being assisted as well on some of the general proposals that can be done. But surely, as I'm saying, is that we don't need to find somewhere what our current government is doing in relation to the fourth industrial revolution. So that we see, when you speak of the department and the labor sector, we see it coming out of as a subset of what the country as a whole is thinking how to respond to this. Then we can now see on the smaller scale of the department, so that you don't think that way and then the rest of the country is thinking that way. So thank you very much, and we then get to the last one. Let's get to the labor center. And I think the data in terms of numbers, where you've got long list of numbers, and then you take it as read. Take it as read and then speak to those numbers. The politics of those numbers and the meaning of those numbers and the impact of those numbers. Yeah. You may proceed. You let's have maybe about 2 minutes or so of that this reorganization, and then those that have got the problem of stomach economics can move to the court.
Okay, bye. Okay. Good morning, Chairperson. Thank you, members.
attached to the presentation, I have the background information. That is annexures. One was the annexure on where each critical report or data center is with all its satellites and visiting points, as well as the, next to the name of the data center in brackets, the establishment of that data center with a number of vacancies plus the vacancy level in terms of percentage expressed as a percentage. I just want to qualify that a visiting point is where we deliver a service either weekly or sometimes bi-weekly, sometimes three times a week, sometimes monthly, depending on the level of work in that particular service delivery point. I've also attached as a background information the leases, the list of leases and the expiry dates of leases of data centers, because that's important for one of the issues that I'm going to raise under general comment. And then in the body of the report, information on the performance of each data center in terms of how many clients they see on average per month or they have seen since the 1st of April. I would like to also indicate that in my report I have indicated where we have got data centers that are based in townships, which for us is important because that's where the vast majority of the Department of Labor clients are. It's also an unfortunate reality that we do not have that many data centers yet in townships. You will see in the body of the report. If you would allow me to check this and then to go to slide number 3. It's on page 2 of the presentation. I see I'm going to make the slide numbers white, not reflecting against the black space. I apologize for that. We have 126 labor centers in the Department of Labor. We have got 40 satellite offices. So it's 166 offices that are staffed on a full-time permanent basis. And then 517 visiting points, which include a number of Tucson service centers that we service as well. If we look at the Eastern Cape on the next slide, you will see that on average they serve 23,000 clients per month. I'm not going to go through checking all the detail that I put in there because it's in the report. I just would like to reflect through the provinces in terms of numbers. For Free State, they service on average just under 14,000 clients a month. And I think we must bear this in mind when we look at the analysis of provinces. Gauteng, clearly, this is the province where the economic hub of the country is. It's also the province with the largest number of data centers, with an average number of clients of 119,000 per month in that province. Nearly a third of the people of the Department of Labor see the service net at the data centers in the Gauteng province. KZN, this province has got a number of just under 51,000 clients that they service. On page 4, which is slide 8, Limpopo, I would like to just talk a number, stop here for a moment. You will see that they've got a fairly high number of clients that are serviced there for such a rural province. And I am informed that one of the reasons here is that you have a lot of people who work in other provinces, particularly Gauteng and Western Cape. And when they become unemployed, they come back home. And that increases the number of clients that have to be serviced in that particular province, as well as the issue of the clients that cross the border and then come to their centers for assistance if they have complaints or other issues that they would like to raise. In the Mpumalanga province, the total average for Limpopo is 43,000, just over 43,000 people which are serviced there. Mpumalanga province, here we have got another challenge, and that is the issue of labor centers areas which have got labor centers which have gone, I don't want to say use the word dead, but whose economic activity has decreased to such an extent that there's very little economic activity, and the economic activity has moved to another area, and this area is either traditionally serviced by a visiting point or it's been serviced by a satellite office. And we have this dichotomy in terms of Sabi, the labor center Sabi and Bushbuckridge, where the economic activity has moved to Bushbuckridge away from Sabi. We are finalizing the processes of...
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, could we get a definition of what a labor center is as opposed to a satellite? I'm getting lost. Sorry.
I'm sorry, Chairperson. Labor center is a full-time office that delivers all the services of the Department of Labor.
UIF,
workman's compensation, inspection services, public employment services. The full suite of services is delivered in a labor center. A satellite office is a smaller, full-time staffed office, but it offers mostly public employment services, and UIF, compensation fund, and a little bit of IAS complaints. But it does not have the full range of services.
Okay, sorry.
Thank you.
I
apologize. Yeah. Coming back then, so that we then swap SABI, the letter center in SABI, and make that then a satellite office, and move the full-time letter center to Bush Park Ridge, to make sure that we can service
that will make the chairman happy.
Will it?
Okay.
So that we can make sure we take the services to where the economic activity or where the population is that needs our services. 26,000 people are serviced in Mpumalanga every month. The Northern Cape, this is the province with the lowest number of, or the lowest population density, but with vast distances that people have to travel. And you will see that this is also reflected in the huge number of visiting points in that province, 93 of those, and the average number of 4,500 people that are serviced by our officials. But bear in mind the distances that they sometimes have to travel to get to the visiting point. We have an anomaly in the Northern Cape which is starting to stick out its head in other provinces with rural towns. And that is that there are many, many of these rural visiting points where banks have closed down, where even the post office does not have an office anymore. They simply have a post delivery point or a postal point there. And that brings challenges in terms of unemployment insurance funds. Because in order for unemployment insurance fund to be paid, the form must be certified by the bank. It's a quicker requirement. That means that clients have to travel to the nearest town to have their bank form certified by the bank, even if we deliver the service there. And often that means that people will bypass the visiting point and say, I have to go to the town in any event, therefore I am going to visit the local. But this is a challenge, and I can remember from my previous province in the Free State that this town called Sofon, 50 kilos from Bloemfontein. There is now literally nothing of that town left. There's no bank, there's no post office, there's a collection point for mail at a cafe in the town. So it really becomes problematic for people if they have to comply to all these regulations, etc. Northern Cape, as I've said, services 4,500 people per month. The Northwest province services 21,600 people roughly. Here we've had serious challenges with service delivery this year. With the Nahaba strikes that we've had, the provincial office, which is the hub for the processing of UIF, compensation fund, etc., is based in the same office building that was the Department of Social Development, where the Department of Social Development is in Northwest. And with the disruption, our people were also prevented from working, which resulted in them having to move to different offices to try to keep the service going. It has improved, and they are now back to being able to work again, but for quite a long time, as you are all aware, there were these disruptions. In the Western Cape, they service 43,500 people on average a month, and here, we are looking at moving the Goodwood satellite office, which is a satellite office of Bellville, moving that to Khayelitsha, so that there is service delivered in Mitchell's Plain and also service delivered in Khayelitsha. And I'm sure members are aware that the Durance office is fully operational, the one that we have established. I would like to, on the next slide, focus the attention of the members to the fact that, on average, in the Department of Labor, per month, we service 326,000 people.
sometimes a bit more, sometimes a bit less, but on average we serve 326,000 people. Now, with the issue of closing of offices, government-owned offices, etc., I thought it good to also inform the committee on the labour centres which have been closed by our own occupational health and safety inspectors due to non-compliance to the Act. And then also in the report, the body of the report has indicated what we, how far we are in dealing with it. These are the labour centres: Johannesburg, Sebokeng, Germiston, Malelang, Pombela and Durban. These six offices have been closed. The provincial office in Bloemfontein was closed, but they have since reopened, so I did not include them. These are ones that are still closed. And as I said in the body of the report, I have indicated what we are doing to correct that. Chairperson, I'm not going to go through the long list of offices identified for physical accommodation. If you will move with me on slide number 17, it's on page 9. General comments. We do experience challenges with sourcing of accommodation. And our challenges are mostly around the fact that we have to use the Department of Public Works as our partner in the procurement of accommodation. We find that their processes are very slow and very inefficient, and that sometimes the building really nearly collapses around you before we start seeing that some movements are made. Department of Public Works has also taken a decision not to renew lease contracts or renew them on a month-to-month, and that leads to serious challenges with the landlords, who are not willing to do and maintain buildings, because they say if they spend millions to maintain buildings but they don't have a contract, they don't know when the department will move out of the accommodation, leading then to the effect of offices being closed, because routine maintenance is not being done as a result of not having leases in contract. And then in terms of government-owned buildings, of which we have a couple, which is also on the list that I have attached for you, there's no strategy from the Department of Public Works to maintain government-owned buildings. And we're not allowed to do it ourselves. We can do it up to a very limited extent, but we can't go out and do it full scale. The DRMA Act prevents us, and we have tried to negotiate to be released from the conditions thereof, which did no success. So what are we doing at the moment to help in terms of our service delivery? We have approached the compensation fund, the UIF, to source accommodation via the public investment corporation, so that we then lease the accommodation from there and make it easier for us to get fit for purpose accommodation. We have provided laptops with cheat cards to our labor centers so that they can service the visiting points and not have a problem of the long queues that come. Me taking a complaint today, come back next month for an answer, as well as the cell phones to assist them. We've also appointed 258 UIF dedicated client service officers who will deal with UIF matters, and 100 compensation fund dedicated client service officers have been approved, and we are in the process of finalizing the appointment thereof. Chairperson, I think I'll stop here. You will allow me.
Okay. No, it's, thanks very much. And honorable members, I think there we are. When I looked at the report, I tried to consider the labor centers and satellite offices together as offices servicing our people. And I try to consider the visiting point as a non-issue, because just an extension of the labor center. If there is anybody in a visiting point, that means that the service is from the labor center. Is that correct? Is that correct interpretation?
The official.
The official,
yeah.
Any official that shows himself or herself at the visiting point, that means that official moves from the labor center. showed our particular place. Actually, in other ways, that 15 points is just part of the river center. It's only that we just get closer to the people. And the instead of the people move into the river center. And so I have tried to do that, those kinds of calculations. And generally, it looks like we're running around 80 on a daily basis. More or less, the office is serving about 80 people on a day. And except that you then have, I think it is Northern Cape. But Northern Cape, I think all of us, we should be knowing best how that province looks like. Northern Cape is a province where you have got villages of about 15, 20 houses. Then the next village of 30 houses is 30 kilometers from that one. When you move from one village to the other, you travel enough. You see. And there is no place where, I don't think there's many of those villages. If they are too small and so scattered, far away from each other. And the one I was aware of, I'm not sure whether it has been changed, that in Northern Cape there is no public transport. Moving from one village to the other, from one town to the other, public transport. People use this. And therefore it's a problem that if you wanted them to go to a particular office that is 100 kilometers from them, then it's a problem. They decide not to comply with anything. But probably then that's what I understand now is that when you've got 4,400, of course that the population of Northern Cape is very low as well. And but then it makes very difficult to give services to people in Northern Cape. Like when you talk about water infrastructure, if you have to put a pipe that takes water to a village. Actually, just the pipe that runs in the bush costs you more than the pipe that you just articulated out. It costs you a hell of a lot just for the pipe to run in the bush from one village to the other. It's highly costly. But of course, that the increase in the, although you call it more, it's the point, mobile offices for Northern Cape is almost one of the appropriate. And honorable members, there you are with the report. We have offices. Of course, that what generated the discussion on this particular matter is exactly what you tried to touch on. But you had offices located during apartheid times. And an office is in Tzaneen. But there is no office in Namakhale or in the village that is 15 or 20 kilometers outside Tzaneen. What is that? It's time or what? It's a village from Tzaneen towards Woodspring. The village that's out there, the town. Emily. That township outside Tzaneen is just towards so you have got an office in Tzaneen, a village. And then now that township has been developed, and a lot of people that are there, and those that have been returned. But then when they need the office, then they must travel there. And the people that are staying in Tzaneen don't need the office. Because they are the middle and the high income, they are waiting, they don't need the UIF for compensation, they are not interested in. They actually drive past that office every day. They don't even stop and get there. The people that need it, they are in that township. But then they've got nothing. And like as we tried to explain, is that you had an office in Lichtenberg and an office in Park, two different labor centers. But those two offices, they are servicing Kabachoyo municipality. We just got 178,000 people. Then in Bushbuck Ridge, then you have a visiting point only. But then you've got about 600,000 people in Bushbuck municipality. So it's actually the vice versa. But of course, that Bushbuck Ridge has grown up after during apartheid and after apartheid, then we have not made those adjustments. The biggest problem is to be responsive in making access to your services. That's not what we have been doing for quite a long time. And certain offices, I think they are even rotten now, that your own inspectors are closing them down. Because as long as we have been there, and then the other issue, of course, is the risk. I'm not sure if I'll start with whether really the risk unit of the department works. I'm not sure. If you have so many offices that the lease agreement have expired in 2016, and then as the government, as a state organ, obliged to give services, but you are giving services in an office which you can be kicked out at any time, surely your risk unit is not working. It's not. Because when I look at the schedule on the offices or the lease that we have here, the department should have got some sort of exemption or some sort of an agreement long ago from the cabinet in terms of institutional accommodation and creating this agreement. This is the Department of Public Works is not assisting you. By now we should have got a way out of that arrangement of depending on the Department of Public Works. Therefore my biggest question is, on your risk unit, what is that that is doing? Doesn't it see that this is one of the biggest challenges of risk in your service delivery? I think we just really just need to talk a little bit more on this. And the office of Johannesburg, when you say Johannesburg office is closed, but then when you go at the back, then you still have offices in Johannesburg, and whether Johannesburg is an office on its own, then there are other offices within the Joburg Metro and whatever that explanation. Honourable members, you have the report, Honourable Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm pleased to see that they've got a permanent office in Bushbuck Ridge, so you can go and check it when you're there. Is it about to open now?
We will have it.
Okay, don't check it yet. Don't check it yet. So I'm pleased about that. The reality is, this is good that we're starting to spread, and I think it's fantastic that you've got some dedicated UIF and compensation commissioners, dedicated people, which will be fantastic because you can then go straight into that queue and get it sorted out. But the reality is, many people go to certain offices and there's a feeling, and I'm talking about Cape Town now because I've got this feedback, that if you go to the Belleville office, for instance, you get great service. You get it quickly done, people know what they're doing, they've got online, they access offices quickly, and they give you answers. But if you go into any one of the townships, you never get service at all. And in fact, this very committee, I'm not sure where we went, but maybe Van Schalkwyk, or Honorable Van Schalkwyk will remember. During working hours, there was no one there. We were standing outside. And then when we asked people, they said, no, we all know you can't come here, you have to go to Belleville. And so it's really the people not so much only the center, but the people that are there and the oversight. In other words, who's in charge of the center? Because now I went 2 weeks ago to the Belleville one, and everyone, long queues, and they said, no, we travel from all over to come here, because this one gives us great service. So people are still spending enormous money. If you live in Khayelitsha, you've got to spend enormous money to get to the Belleville office, and it's no good having an office there that's non-functional. So maybe you want to comment on that. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. May I want to welcome the report that has been presented, and also I want to start with one of the work to make points of the vacancy rate. But I want to single out a little explanation why it is that the Malanga, the Koko, and North West a vacancy rate of 110%. It's extremely high. It's void of quality. In Chairperson, we spoke about the state of the labor center, where we found that we have a labor center and it's not properly resourced to effectively service the people. But we don't get an idea of the resources of the labor center in any of these reports. So we have to go to a specific labor center to see what's happening on the ground. So if we can get something, just a comment around that. But also in terms of as we sometimes wait to visit some labor centers, we'll find that there's no proper security measures in place in terms of securing the safety of the staff. And also the conditions, if there are in some instances conditions where under those security are working their environment. So if we can get some indication in terms of that, but also in terms of the resources, do you have, when you allocate resources, are you taking the material conditions into consideration? For example, when you allocate the resources to a rural office, you know that you can't use or allocate a normal sedan, for instance. It's not going to be a cost effective in the long run. Some centers where I visited, they took me and they said, we have a shortage of vehicles. And then I say, but according to the knowledge that I have, you are supposed to have this many vehicles. And when I go, they showed me, and they said, we have it. But it's not, it can't be, it's irreparably broken down. And we're not using it for a long time, then it's breaking again. Because in this area, we need, for instance, 4x4. That's the kind of adequate resources that I'm referring to. Then, in terms of the lease period, for instance, I'm looking at Animal Law, for instance. The lease ended 31st of March 2012. So now this period between 2012 and 2018, 2019 that we're going through, the period that the owners are not necessarily going to provide service in terms of maintenance. And then they have a list of offices that have been closed down due to non-compliance with OHA. Are you monitoring the status of those labor centers, especially those who are outside of Benue period that hasn't been renewed, what is the actual status of labor centers, especially in terms of OHS? Because we don't want, we want to be proactive. We don't want to be in the firing line, we don't want to be in the newspaper, the headline news, in terms of non-compliance. And we knew about this thing, but we didn't know how worse the situation is. You see what I mean? I'm sure you understand what I mean. So many of them might be non-compliant at this stage because of maintenance, of poor maintenance, and due to the need to be closed down. Then, you are talking about the relationship of yourself and public workers in terms of the authority. Do you have a plan or a structure or a mechanism in place to engage public work or take it to a higher level to ensure compliance in terms of this voting or in terms of the lease and things like that? Because or if the lease are outdated, then surely the terms and conditions as being contained in the original leases are not valid again. So that's also a point of concern. Then I don't have sufficient knowledge to scrutinize the rest of the provinces, so I'll speak to the Northern Eastern, you will pardon me. Especially in terms of leases versus state-owned. You've identified the areas or the towns that or offices that in terms there in terms of the leases, and then there's another page that identifies the state-owned accommodation. But there is an omission. I don't know what is the status of Kimberley because it's nowhere. So
labor center was
the labor center. Mm-hmm. Because surely we must get an indication in terms of are they on lease, is it state owned or what. I'm not sure that scenario might play itself out in the other provinces as well. So can I then assume or can you clarify to us if they officers that's not on lease and they're not state-owned, what are their statuses? That's the question that I want to ask. So, Chairperson, the other issue is in terms of that move of the satellite from Hutu to Kwaeritsha. I just want to commend that move because I'm one of the people who's been advocating or requesting that needs to come closer to the people, and we are very satisfied and pleased that the department are trying to ensure that there's movement. But then again, we don't have timeline in terms of that. The other question is, Chairperson, with regards to new satellite offices or servicing points, do you have something a plan in terms of that in mind, and what is your plan in terms of looking into the future, especially in areas where you see that the service needs are high? What is the plan in terms of that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And
then
I'll ask
Chair
can we look at the office allocations in terms of provinces, the state value of the provinces, and just explain to us the numbers inside the bracket, how to read them. I really don't know how to read them. Somewhere I'm just seeing 1 of 19-5%. What all that means. And then you go to Western Cape. Western Cape, the last page. Then you have got Booster. Then you have got a long list of offices or small little towns or whatever, or villages. What does that mean? And then one would be, I think it's crazy about that. But the other thing that I have. Then that section for alternative accommodation. Labor centers identified for alternative accommodation as of that part, Oyando, 41, Kosovo, Albania, Kimberley, Utaka, Mount Eli. What are the reasons for looking for alternative accommodation? Then this is placed in the Bethlehem, all that metrospectrum. I think that is the one question that I wrote on that. And the last one I think is it is what Honorable Van Carl Vick has indicated on state on accommodation. And then the same for those rooms. Because those that are privately owned, you can just demand something to do that. And those that are state owned, they are in the hands of public work. But now, given the challenge is really of public work, and then what happened? So the day that it is closed by the inspector, that is what I have a long think of going back into that building. We have closed Johannesburg. What are the officers in that Johannesburg office doing now? And how are they doing it? We have closed Mobel. How are they? Where are they waiting? What are they doing? And how are they doing it? Because surely if you are going to try and keep them busy by telling them to go to nearby labor centers, then you're going to start having problems of overtime, extra pay, mileage, and transport. They are using their own cars, some of them. Because you can't have a car for everybody. You may proceed. I think in 15 minutes time, we should be done. Okay.
Let me start off by saying that the bulk of the questions raised around these agreements and the risk management issue that was brought up, alternative accommodation, and so on, the head of the chief financial officer. Mr. Bronkhorst will talk to a bulk of the questions. But yeah, I just wanted to corroborate some of the things that you put on the table when you talk about the special arrangement of countries and they're being driven by the pre-democratic period. And I mean, one thing that you spoke about earlier on when you were taking the question, the presentation on the fourth industrial revolution, was how ready are we in terms of automating some of our processes. And we know that with the UI, some of the things are really automated. And people that have got more sophistication are able to access services without necessarily needing to go to the brick and mortar. So your analysis is correct in that way, because they can do easy solutions, they can do e-training, and so forth. And the other thing that I wanted to talk to was the whole issue on raised by Honorable Bagley, that you find that there is a preference for certain offices to serve others. Mm-hmm. And then put that on the spotlight, because you find that where people get services on time services, they'll prefer to go there, even if it means they incur an extra charge. And you talk more on that as well, but it's something that have also come on our radar. And the issue of customization of cars, we need to provide for cars that are customized for areas that are in operation. Like, we know that in other instances, you find that the roads are not user-friendly for students and all that. And I'm sure the CFO can also add on this. And the last thing, the issue about monitoring of
our office is that compliance. Actually, just getting back looking into making sure that we inspect all our offices. This week we did the UN and the compensation fund. And where we find that the housekeeping issue to handle them as such, but where we find that there is potential danger to the employees, that we pick up the offices to the close, because we put the interest of employees before anything else.
It's interesting if it's a certain feature now, because I may think that, you know, if you want people in Belleville to have some sort of leave or free time, then you can just go and close their office.
Mm-hmm.
Then they are on leave, then they stay at home.
Thank you.
Let me respond to the ones that I will do in terms of the questions of the Joburg Labour Centre that is closed, and for that matter of fact, any other labour centre which is closed. Officials are then either accommodated at the visiting points where we have an office, or at satellite offices, or at labour centres close by. That is why you would see that there is performance for the Johannesburg Labour Centre, and why they names of offices or visiting points under Joburg, although Joburg is a physical office closed. The people are still being utilized to service those offices as if it was part of the labor tender. excuse me. I agree with you fully that when people get someone who services them, that they would bypass all those offices. We were talking about it this morning that I get calls from I don't know where, and someone will say, oh, there's an Afrikaans cinema, can I speak Afrikaans, but it's someone I can't serve. You get that quite a lot. It is a reality that not all offices are on the same standard, and we have started with a process to make sure that service delivery is improved to be on the same level. Provincial management teams are working on that to ensure that this happens. We've also embarked on the process of skilling our managers in labor centers to be on the level that we would want them to be in order to make sure that our service delivery happens. The issue of the vacancy rate of offices, and I would like to incorporate your question about Mpumalanga and Limpopo and Northwest. Indeed, it is a concern to us, and we have embarked on a plan to recruit people in the areas so that we can fill the vacancies, the entry-level positions, mostly in labor centers. Here and there, they are more specialized positions, where one would find that as an employment counselor and so on, but where the entry-level position can be finalized in the labor centers. We do have challenges in Mpumalanga, structural challenges in the HR in unit there, and we have had challenges in Limpopo as well, structural in HR in units, which we have addressed, and which is only now starting to improve. Northwest was the whole issue which I alluded to earlier of the influence of the unrest and the destabilization there. They could not work. It was not possible for them to work. That has also started to improve now after the stabilization of the environment. The issue of the physical resources, I think the CFO will talk about the vehicles, etc. But provinces, labor centers are requested to give their input on what they need. And then you know how it comes up to the top, and then eventually we make that. And the same holds true for vehicles. We don't just decide we'll give them a Volkswagen or whatever car. We ask whether they need, but everyone would want a 4x4. It's not always possible to issue them, so we also have to weigh that there as well. The issue of I think the Department of Public Works, our relationship with them, the CFO will also talk about that. Kimberly, I see it's been omitted, I don't know why, but it is a leased building. It's not a state owned. It slipped through, I'm very sorry for that.
No. But the relationship of labor and public works is not something that is in your office. Because you should be the person that is studying. To them time and again, other than the CFO in terms of payment.
Jefferson, the CFO, part of his portfolio is physical resources in terms of accommodation. Therefore, on a provincial level, there are relationships with the Department of Public Works on a provincial level, which is managed by the head of the department office in the province. But in the national level, that falls in the portfolio of the CFO. The issue of the numbers in brackets in the provinces, after the name of the labor center, the number that you will find there in brackets, say for example 2 of 16, it means the establishment of that office is 16, two vacancies, there are two vacancies, which translates to 13%. If we just say, okay. Yeah, it talks to the vacancy rate, that particular number. If we look with Alba North, they've got 2 of 16. 13% of their votes are vacant. It translates into that. And then the question of Worcester with a long list of names, those are the visiting points serviced by the Worcester Labour Centre. If we go to the Western Cape, Jefferson, where you request. You'll see Worcester on page 9. And it says 1 of 34, and then the whole list of names on the left is Sperenberg. Those are the visiting points serviced by that particular labor center.
Yeah, but do you see the number of those visiting points? How many are they?
Yes.
There is the people that are at the labor center, 34. So then there's a possibility that one, so that certain visiting points are not even being studied. Otherwise the labor center would be vacant with no official, all of them out to the visiting point. How do you operationally, how is it done?
Many of these visiting points are serviced on the same day. Very small visiting points where there might be one or two clients only. So they would, and I can't here now say to you, they take, say for example, Langebaan, Leipoldville, Lutzeville, and so on one day. I don't have that with me here. But many of those visiting points are done in circuitous routes, and they start at 8 o'clock, and they'll be at the one till 10, and then move and be at the other one from 11, and so on. So that they do 3, 4, 5 visiting points in a day, especially if it's a small visiting point. And some of them are serviced.
Okay, no, it's fine. I think when we come and do the expenditure report, I think we'll get more information. You would have actually got more information. How is it done with so many, when you have got so few officials in the labor center? Because when these people get out of the labor center, we are not saying all the people are getting out.
No,
can't. Majority must be in that labor center only. So which means it's a small portion that goes out. But then you've got a long list of areas to be visited. So which means you've got a situation where some of these visiting points, they just spend 30 minutes. They just go there, wherever they find it, then they help. When they've just finished helping him, then they go to the next one. So which means other people may need them. When they just let other people arrive, then they are not there. Then they must wait until for the next cycle of visit. So it's, maybe if you, in our next expenditure report briefing, we can just get some sort of clarity.
Jefferson, thank you.
I've
made a note. We will do that in the I just want to check whether those I have to answer. I think the rest will be the CFO to respond to.
Thanks. The issue of leases, maybe let me start with probably indicating that both leases and government buildings are handled by Public Works. In terms of our relationship, it has been quite difficult. I think Public Works has had some challenges. At some point, they even withdrew the delegations given to their provincial offices in terms of approving
and as a result quite a number of administrative work was finalized at their head office, which proved to be very, very difficult for all, not just the Department of Labor, but all clients' departments. This has been normalized. We are now working with their provincial offices. However, there are still challenges. With regards to the government buildings, which is probably the easier one, not so easy, they have proposed, or what currently works in terms of finances is that in our allocation, we've got capital allocation for buildings that belong to government, wherein public works invoice us 25% for each and every quarter. They complained that I think that amount that they were collecting from us is not enough for them to maintain government buildings. So there's currently a proposal by them. They've developed what they call a user charge. It's sort of a square meter, a rate per square meter, which is almost similar to the property industry, but I think just for government. It hasn't taken off as yet, because when they presented that user charge to us, some departments had some shortfall in terms of what is in our allocation vis-a-vis the square meterage that we occupy government buildings. So we wouldn't be able to pay all the money in terms of that user charge. So they are currently working on that together with Treasury, because some departments had shortfalls, others had surpluses. So I'm hoping that in this allocation that we just received, that has been corrected in terms of making sure that everyone receives amount as per the proposed user charge by the public works, which they then indicated that once they got that amount, they will be able to maintain the government buildings. In terms of the leases are negotiated by public works. We sent our request to them. They have been given some, I'm not sure whether a parliament or treasury, in terms of giving them some allowances to normalize the expired lease. That has been happening quite some time. They started now. They were called in a meeting this financial year for them to propose that they are going to convert those 1-2 months to five years or 10-year lease, but following a procurement process that they will agree with National Treasury. So all the leases that have expired have been handled by them, all the month-to-month. But also not only that, the issue is, as we are occupying the building, all the complaints that we have with the landlord, the lease is between the public works and the landlord. We are just occupants. What public works has tried to do on some emergency issues, he has given us some leeway to do some emergency repairs that they would probably recover from the landlord. But they are the ones who are maintaining those leases. They are not in our risk register per se. They are supposed to manage that. Albeit they have been having challenges for quite some time. Probably it will be right that maybe when we present, more especially the leases, they are we here with us also to explain the changes, their assistance to the departments, not only the Department of Labor. That covers the leases part. In terms of vehicles, I think my colleague has indicated the process. Safe to say that in this financial year, the RT contract by the Department of Transport expired, and as a result, it resulted in us being late in procuring. We are waiting for our procurement of vehicles for this year. They indicated 120 days up to January. So all the offices that have made their request for vehicles, they will receive those vehicles that they have requested by the end of January. I think they would have received. It's quite delayed. We normally do it somewhere around April, May. So this year, because of the the new tender that Department of Transport issued. I think the finalization thereof took some time, but I think it's now on the go. I think I've covered the issues and the
CFO, I think there is a challenge. We are not processing the interest of the Department of Labor. The question that the leases are organized by public works cannot mean us to raise hands and say that is the job of public works. Somebody in labor should be managing this business and blowing the whistle at the right time. And again, it's your inspector who investigates buildings that you occupy. They should inspect them at certain intervals that you are informed of the state of the building that you are occupying before they go and close that building. You can't have a situation where your own inspector go in the building, inspect, and close the building. That means they have not been going there for ages. They only went there because somebody was complaining, because the door is no longer closing. But if they inspect at certain intervals, they will tell you and give you a warning that when you come back after so many as inspector, this building will close it unless you fix 1, 2, 3. So you tell us that you have got the right to reserve minor repairs. Surely then they will warn you on certain things that they would like to be done. But now, if we find ourselves where our own inspectors have closed our own offices, something's wrong, somebody is not managing something for us. And that issue of the vehicles as well, Honorable Pascal, it just simply leads us to a poor contract management. You can't have a contract that elapses, and then you start the procurement. Somebody should be saying that our contract is going to elapse in the next 9 months. Then you start procuring, knowing the time that your procurement will take must coincide with the end of that contract, and then the new contract should be signed. Just all about management. Some other people are sleeping somewhere else. And it can't be correct. Let's protect the interests of the department. And then, it's you who have got an interest in those lease agreements, because you have got equipment of the Department of Labor in there. Now that in those buildings, you have got no official lease, the security of all those equipment is gone. If they are stolen tomorrow, these people here, they don't have whatever, and then now if the landlord and public works don't agree, then you can't claim what you have lost in the building. Because your basis of claiming either from insurance or whatever will be based on the lease agreement. Then there's no lease agreement. There's a gentleman's agreement on a monthly basis. We just need to protect the interest of the department. And that's all. And then if there are reports or whatever that needs to be submitted to the DG and to cabinet, let it be submitted if the Department of Public Works is not assisting. And get a solution out there, innovative, and get a solution out there. I hear this other part that you are using the CF and whatever for them to get the accommodation through the PIC and then you squatter in there. But if you think that is the best way of doing it, then let us provide with this video a full scale that we avoid all these problems of public works. Sitting with the disagreement that has expired in 2012, it can't be correct. It can't be correct. Surely we are not worried about the interest of the department. Absolutely.
Thank you, Chair. I want to welcome the representative to the election. But just in case to mention, that when I refer to resources, I make the example of the vehicle. But I also I'm also speaking about other resources, your fax machine systems, those kind of things that, that keeps the machine on the go and keeps it running, expedite service delivery to the people. But also when I talk about, when the CFO mentioned about the lease amounts in terms of public works and stuff like that, can you give us some kind of comparison in terms of private owners and state-owned amounts? What is the difference? Is there a difference out or are you privy to that information? And also there's something that I wanted to check. In the presentation I've seen that the number of clients per month since April that has been served. So I just need to know if you have the information at hand in comparison to the previous year, the same period. Is it more or is it less or more or less the same? So that we can just get an indication if more people make use of the service, less of people, and then they will clearly give an indication of where to in terms of provision of service and also in terms of the service centers. I haven't yet got feedback back in terms of when the satellite of Kailicha will open. Thank you.
Now, just before you speak, can I just, honorable members, can I just request honorable Pascal, please, just simply to close the meeting on my behalf. And I'm just rushing to a meeting with the Secretary of the Minister. Just after this response, then I think the meeting will be finished.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Chair. The issue of the resources, the same principle holds true. Is a manager in an office must identify need for the resource and request the resource. As you will know, I can't be there at all the offices. So it is dependent on what I get from the ground in terms of, that is why we have embarked on the process of the laptops and the phones, because that was something that I got from the ground to make sure that people, so they must ask and will be provided. The issue of the numbers of clients, I do not have it here today, but I will provide it and I will give you a comparison together with the other information that was also requested by the chairperson, and I provide it to the secretary if that is fine for circulation to you. Then Goodwood, the manager there told me that it would be 1 April, but I'm doing another correction. I would rather want to confirm that what I recall is correct. And also then inform you.
In terms of the, maybe the issue that I wanted the second bite on in terms of the RT contract, that's the RT contract from the Department of Transport, where all government departments utilize that contract to procure vehicles. They are the ones who delayed in terms of finalizing the procurement process. So before they could finalize, we could not procure the vehicles because we made an order from them. In terms of lease management, we are managing it quite tightly, but the problem, well, our limitation is that we cannot then, it's not the signatory to the contract and lies directly with the leases. Our management goes straight to the public work. So if they've got challenges, so that's where we then escalate it to the DG for management. We are trying, oh look, with the landlord, we've got a cordial relationship just to get the things going there. But if it gets to the point where we have to escalate, we'll have to come back to public work because the lease is signed between the public work and the landlord.
Thank you very much. To the department for that response. Do we have anything else, honorable members, that you want to engage in terms of the presentation?
Just one comment. Thanks. About 4 years ago, this committee complained about the lease and the building at the CCMA in Cape Town. They're still in the same building and you still can't go to the toilet. In fact, I've seen some people go behind the building to relieve themselves. What's going on there?
I don't have the answer. I'm not going to have it. But allow me to come back to you on that.
Thanks.
One, and then I'll give you some feedback.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. So I think that's all for now. At this stage, honorable members, I want to thank you for the engagement and for the active participation as well as the presentation that has been made by the department and our organization. And on that stage, our website, I want to declare that we have been officially closed.
Just before we actually go, apparently there's a Human Rights Commission comment on affirmative action. Sorry, apparently there is a Human Rights Commission report on affirmative action given to the Minister of Labour. Can we get a copy of that report? She's received the report yesterday, apparently, on affirmative action. We'd like to try and get it.
We'll ask through the Office of the Chairperson to formally request to the department or to the ministry. On that note, you're making a note, Mr. President, thank you. Then the meeting is officially closed, thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Willie. Thanks for having me here.
If they don't have their house in order, and it's in a local center because it's Yama, we can't even find our own house in the
community. It's for their information. It's for the information.
Okay.
That's a lot of chat. They're vulnerable.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
107 million. 29, 30 something, 40, 29, 39, 40. So the MRT is 33, that's 29 million, I think it can go along. Oh, in fact, not only for me, for the whole 9 years.
Yeah.
Because the 33 that we estimate, so more probably 29.
Yeah.
We need to go more, so we might probably squeeze some of the things.
Okay.
But to plan the 29 or the following year, of course.
Mm.
So.
No, I just wanted to find out to put what is it?
Yeah, we are.
Yeah. I think
the lady was doing the presentation that happened, was she? From the department of labor.
Oh, sorry, not
Tendani.
Tendani.
Oh,
okay.
One of the reasons.